Is this the real deal? J.D. Vance is apparently off this weekend to finally sign a deal with Iran, open the Strait of Hormuz, and end the war. Britain, meanwhile, has been shocked with yet another incident of migrant violence, a man beheaded on the streets of Belfast. Will this be the final straw? The Ukraine war has gone on for longer than World War I this week. What's next to be past that pretty momentous milestone? We're going to look at all of this and more on today's Trumpet World. Well, I feel like President Trump doesn't make our job easy on this show because just about every Friday we have a new, for real, honest this time peace deal, or Donald Trump is about to start bombing and the war is about to kick off for real. It's all back on again. We have another peace deal now. I'm joined by Mihailo Zekic, our Middle East correspondent. Mihailo, is this different from where we've been before, where another peace deal is round the corner? Like, is there anything substantively different, or is this once again something that seems like it could well evaporate come Monday?
Well, by the time people watch this episode over the weekend, we could have a definite answer, but I would say there is some substantial progress for this time around than before. The main ones being through leaks to the media, which we'll get to a little bit later, we're actually seeing some of the provisions reportedly that this peace deal would include, that the nuclear negotiations, the next level after this peace deal, will deal with, coming from some sources that are hostile, relatively speaking, to the administration. With that being said, as of June 9th, CNN had a report saying that since March, President Trump has declared peace to be imminent 38 times. I guess we could say 39 now. So, and obviously for all of these discussions, the main thing we have to go with is his own statements, which are intentionally contradictory often. But I do think that there is enough reason to suspect this time might be different.
So there may well be substance to this deal. What do we know of what's in the deal itself?
Well, the repeated source of leaks confirms what we've discussed before on this program. The fact that we're hearing it over and over again suggests it's legitimate. Extending the ceasefire itself for 60 days to continue negotiations, opening up the Strait of Hormuz, guaranteeing that Iran will not be charging tolls over the waterway in exchange for sanctions relief. And most crucially, I think it's safe to say, is that the nuclear negotiations will continue. And we have, through leaks to the media again, reported frameworks for these nuclear talks. It seems as if they're almost actually about settled. There may not be much left to iron out in that 60 days if it gets approved. What I think is most interesting, at least from the nuclear perspective, is from the details we can glean, again, if the reports are to be believed, it looks almost exactly like Barack Obama's 2015-2016 JCPOA. I've made this point before on this program, but the more details come out, the more we could be more confident about that. The New York Times is the main source in this case for what the nuclear discussions are looking like. According to a June 9 report, President Trump has reportedly agreed to a sunset clause. He originally wanted a 20-year suspension. Iran said 10. According to the Times sources, it may be closer to 15, which the sunset clause is one of the big reasons why President Trump pulled out of the original deal in the first place. That's basically Iran isn't permanently forbidden of building a nuclear weapon. It's just forbidden from these years. And then once that's over, they can keep doing what they're doing. It's basically an open admission of kicking the can down the road. Iran also can reportedly keep its uranium potentially to dilute it in its own territory? In other words, for America can trust the Iranians supposedly to water down its own uranium. We've been there before again. The U.S. is hoping that Iran will close its main three nuclear sites, Fordo, Natanz, and Isfahan. Iran is saying they want to keep at least one of them open. That was, again, the same thing with JCPOA. Fordo was open. And from these scant details from the Times, apparently Iran's other nuclear sites, like at Pickaxe Mountain, which we've discussed before, like at Parchin, which they specifically stopped from being included in the JCPOA. Those are not part of the agreement. And President Trump is demanding that Iran allow the International Atomic Energy Agency or other groups to come in and monitor and verify Iran's compliance. Iran did that with the JCPOA, two of the sites they wanted them to come. And for the stuff they didn't want the IAEA to see, that was just all swept under the rug. Of course, it's not a given that this is exactly going to happen. The president is famously mercurial. But Vice President Vance, who, as you mentioned, the president said he could be heading to Europe any day now to formally sign an agreement, he called the current progress a, quote, home run for the American people. He also said that the one bad thing about the Obama-era deal was that the inspectors, the international verifiers, didn't have free rein over any part of the agreement that they wanted to. There was, again, a lot more that was bad about the Obama deal, a lot more that President Trump himself pointed out that is reportedly in this same deal that they're negotiating right now. And even if Iran was to open up in some respects, again, as before, they let the inspectors see only what they want to see, which continues the facade.
So how similar is this to the JCPOA? Like, because we've seen people accusing Donald Trump of saying, well, this is similar to the Obama nuclear deal. We talked about Melanie Phillips about that last week. At the same token, he could have signed a deal with Iran had he just wanted to completely fold to Iran a couple of months ago. So is this a case of Iran kind of outweighed Donald Trump and now he's willing to sign something that is pretty similar to what was on the table 2 months ago? Or are there any genuine differences?
Well, the main differences that a few people have noted is some of the token aspects of the deal that President Obama included, like, say, snapback sanctions. Those were part of the JCPOA, but President Obama was never going to enforce them, even though Iran started breaking the deal almost immediately. President Trump has signaled that he intends things to be different. Closing, say, all three nuclear sites, having inspections over all of Iran's enriched uranium to make sure it isn't just stored away across the border in Russia, but actually rendered unusable, that would be a bit different. But these, even if they are marginally better, these aspects, they're nothing that Iran couldn't undo with a bit of hard work, maybe a little harder work than before, but not by much. Lee Smith recently had an article in Tablet about how if America isn't willing to go in and cut off the head of the snake, so to speak, if it isn't willing to keep active fighting until Iran has no choice but to surrender, until Iran shows itself as the weaker power that just can't withstand the attack, an Obama-style nuclear deal is really the only option President Trump can settle for. And I think the biggest sign we have of how nuclear negotiations are going is the scant whispers from Israel in terms of press releases, in terms of comments from Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu showing he's really, really concerned with how this deal is going. If this was a deal that actually would denuclearize Iran and make the Middle East a safer place, Israel would be wholeheartedly supporting it. Israel, of course, was fighting alongside America. I think it didn't take them long to figure out that regime change in Iran wasn't going to happen. Iran was still going to stay functional by the end of this war somehow. But they still had, I guess you could say, victory options on what they would settle for in that scenario. Okay, maybe Iran's neutered to the point it can't hurt us anymore, even if they're still having problems inside Tehran. If this was a step towards that, the Israelis would be supporting it, but they're not.
Well, we've also got Andrew Miller, our US correspondent, joining us as well as we talk about this to add an American perspective on this deal. So, I mean, Andrew, what are your thoughts here?
I think this is a perfect illustration of what our executive editor, Mr. Stephen Fleury, calls peace derangement syndrome. One of my favorite news sites, the Babylon Bee, has said this week that Trump definitely deserves the Nobel Peace Prize because he's won the war in Iran 27 times this year. So you can definitely see some desperation on the part of the American government. The Strait of Hormuz has been closed for months. That's driven up fuel prices worldwide. We just got out a new inflation report that inflation's actually up to 4% in America now, which is the highest it's been in like 40 months. Not due to the fact that the currency is devaluing faster than usual, but just due to the fact that fuel prices are so high and everything you buy at the grocery store gets there on a truck. So it's the gas prices driving up. So we're going into midterm elections. Americans, they want lower gas prices. They want cheaper groceries. The average citizen doesn't seem to, like, they might want Iran to be defeated, but they don't seem to be willing to sacrifice much for that goal. So President Trump, he's very anxious to, like, wrap this up, put a bow on it, get it behind him, start focusing on elections. He's trying to negotiate a deal to get out of this situation. And not realizing, as like journalists like Melanie Phillips have brought out before, that the main problem with the Obama deal, it wasn't that it was a bad deal, it was that it existed. The fact that you're making a deal with an Islamist state, they follow Shia Islam, and it's actually a tenet of Shia Islam that it's not a sin to lie to an infidel if it's furthering the goals of Islam. So this regime's, they're willing to tell any lie they have to make sure the Islamist regime endures, that it does get a nuclear power, and that it continues to be the world's largest sponsor of terrorism and the king of the Middle East. They know that Donald Trump only has 2 more years in office. They're just trying to run down the clock, so some of this back and forth. So they may get a deal this time if Donald Trump's desperate to wrap this up. But the U.S. administration, they're looking at this with blinders on. They're wanting to believe the best, that this is a home run for the American people, that they can get out of this and claim a victory. When the fact is that anything other than, and any deal is a defeat for the United States. The only victory would be U.S. dictating terms and Iran accepting them. President Trump said, I don't know, well over a month ago, that like the only thing he's going to accept in Iran is unconditional surrender. The only thing that would work in Iran is unconditional surrender. But you're definitely, this is not, the fact that he's saying that, like, Supreme Leader Mujtaba may or may have signed off on this deal is not a surrender. This is doing something that the Islamist regime in Iran is going to be happy with. That's the only if the Islamist regime's not happy with it, then the war will continue until America eventually does come up with a deal that the Iranian regime is happy with.
So you mentioned Melanie Phillips. There's a number of different commentators that we've been looking at that often have a lot of good insight when it comes to trying to work out what is the truth behind the rhetoric and the reality. You know, Donald Trump will always play up these deals as fantastic and, well, what is actually going on? What else do you have for us from those kind of commentators, Mihailo?
Well, one big one I would like to mention is Jonathan Tobin, the editor-in-chief of Jewish News Syndicate. He had a really good analysis of everything that's going on. I'll quote from his commentary. The basic premise of a Trump-Iran deal would be the same as Obama's. It would, as the Times rightly points out, be as completely dependent on Iranian cooperation as the JCPOA. And anyone who thinks they will fully cooperate with the United States on this and not cheat on a new deal, as they did on the old one, has learned nothing from the past two decades of behavior from Tehran. Further down, a deal on the terms that are being discussed will mean that Iran won the war that began on February 28th, no matter what Trump might say about it, end quote. And he was referring to the New York Times piece I earlier cited. And he goes on to say that what Steve Witkoff and Jared Kushner, the main two negotiators in this deal, the premise that they're working with is in Iran is the same premise that President Obama was claiming the old Iran deal on, that Iran just wants to be brought back into the normal international community. It wants to be treated like an equal country. Once we play on the interests of money and getting all these trade routes up and going, that is going to fix the issue. What Mr. Tobin doesn't say is that, while that may be what President Obama told the public, behind the scenes, he didn't actually believe that himself. He wanted to support Iran rising up. He wanted to clandestinely help Iran in a way that he couldn't do if he was being honest. But Mr. Witkoff, Mr. Kushner, and by extension, Mr. Trump, even if they actually do believe that premise, that is still the same premise they are working on. And I thought that was very interesting in light of what our editor-in-chief, Mr. Gerald Fleury wrote or was published this Monday, called The Deadly Delusion in the Iran Talks. This is what he had to say about this. As I write in my book, America Under Attack, President Obama made this deal, the JCPOA, because he shared Iran's goal of destroying America. President Trump doesn't have that goal. He is entering negotiations in naivety and pride in his own ability rather than outright maliciousness. But if he doesn't change course, the end result will be the same. Further down, he says, now we see President Trump continuing Obama's work. So even if the mindset of this negotiations is different, even if it comes from an actual desire to make America safer, etc., etc., he's doing the exact same thing Obama is doing. It's the point Mr. Tobin brings out. And as one person I know often says, if you keep doing what you're doing, you're going to keep getting what you're getting. If you keep moving forward with this kind of a nuclear deal, you're going to get the same result that the other deal had, which is Iran getting closer to building a nuclear bomb, which is why President Trump left the old deal in the first place. Mr. Fleury continues in his article, quote, the Iranians are terrorists to the core. President Trump's hope that these terrorists can be used in a peaceful transition is delusional. He shouldn't even be talking to them. As Andrew mentioned, the problem was that the deal before was a bad deal. The problem was that there was a deal in the first place. Iran only talks, Mr. Fleury mentions later, Iran only starts its talks when it feels like it's going to win. And we'll see exactly where these talks, where these trends end up going. But there's no reason to suspect that they won't fall through with this path. And if that's the case, then, as Mr. Fleury elaborates, America is going to be in a far, far darker place. And if our viewers would like to learn more, I highly recommend seeing Mr. Fleury's article, The Deadly Delusion in the Iran Talks.
Well, thank you. Thank you for that, Mihailo. One other story I wanted to bring from the Middle East that I wrote up briefly this week, so I figured I might as well bring it, is that, sadly, this is the day of the Homosexual Pride Parade in Tel Aviv. We had the Homosexual Pride Parade in Jerusalem on June 4th, just over a week ago. That one is smaller, but I think, that one is smaller, but I think it's pretty significant that it's such an in-your-face attack on God to have a pride parade, a pride in a perverse lifestyle, in Jerusalem. But then the Tel Aviv one is much bigger. You might remember we also talked, I think, about this Pride Land celebration planned for the site of Sodom and Gomorrah or in the Dead Sea. And that was originally scheduled when we talked about it for June 1st to June 4th. Now it seems like it's scheduled for July 1st to July 4th. Just knowing what I know about event organizing, it wouldn't at all surprise me if it gets canceled, just because the website is still, last time I looked, was still under construction, and it just didn't seem like they were anywhere near ready to host an event of the scale and ambition that they were wanting to. But such an audacious thing to do anyway, to be, that's what your scale and ambition is all about, is having a big celebration on the site of Sodom and Gomorrah about perversion. With Israel heading to elections, going back to the Jerusalem parade, it was much more of a political event. This whole issue of homosexual pride is looking like it's going to become a bit of an election issue. So the chairman of the march's organizer, Jerusalem Open House, said it's always more like a protest than anything else, this year especially. And they're up for elections. I think, Mihailo, you've talked about before, about Naftali Bennett is kind of leading the opposition to Benjamin Netanyahu. He is a religious Zionist, but as part of his opposition to Netanyahu, he has compromised with this so-called LGBT movement. He said that if elected, he'll move Israel closer towards legalizing homosexual quote-unquote marriage. He's been a little bit cagey as to exactly how or what, but he has made carefully worded statements that indicate he wants to compromise, or that he will compromise with this movement. In Jerusalem, you had about 10,000 marchers guarded by about 2,000 police. And people that came out to counter-protest, they said they were treated like criminals despite having done nothing wrong. Tel Aviv's parade today is the first full-size parade that Israel has had since October 7th. You know, last year it was canceled because of Iranian bombs. The year before, it was a shrunken down Pride and Hope rally is what they called it. But you know, it's worth bringing out because this is why Israel hasn't been protected. This is why Israel wasn't protected from what the violent terrorists and Hamas, the murderers, did on October 7th. I mean, Hamas is evil, but God could have protected them from that evil. Iran is evil. And yeah, God is allowing Iran to be brought back down to size, but Iran, the threat is not being eliminated. And if Israel wants protection from Iran, it needs to move away from, it needs to repent. It needs to get away from this behavior. There was one member of the Knesset, he said that Israel's homosexual movement is the most dangerous thing for the state of Israel, more than Islamic State, more than Hezbollah, more than Hamas. And I think he's spot on. Mr. Armstrong said that the downward plunge in morals was rapidly becoming a greater threat to humanity than the hydrogen bomb. Mr. Stephen Flurry had an article that we can put in the show notes, What is Israel's Sin?, that he wrote talking about October 7th, refuting some of the anti-Semitic attacks that you have against Israel, that are kind of, Israel deserved this because they were mistreating the Palestinians or something like that, which is complete rubbish. But he points out there, Isaiah 59 and verse 2 says that when we harbor sin in our life, God hides himself from us. He will not hear our prayers and we lose his protection. That sin separates us from God and joins us with the chief terrorist, our adversary, the devil. That is why Satan's primary objective is to get us to coexist with evil, even if just a little bit, because he knows that it will grow. And you had, on October 7th, many of those victims were attending an all-night rave full of illegal drugs, full of excessive drinking on the Sabbath day, on a high holy day, an annual Sabbath. That October 7th attack was a warning that Israel was depriving itself of God's protection. And we're now, 2.5 years on from that? And Israel has not heeded that warning, and they're back to their full-scale celebrations of perversion. So this is why Iran wasn't taken care of. That was another article that we had in the Trumpet print. Why did America not manage to defeat Iran? It's because of America's sins. This is why Donald Trump is left compromising with Iran. It's because of the sin and weakness within America and the sin and weakness within Israel. They're separated from God. And Britain, of course, has its sin and weakness as well. And Britain has its attacks. And this week we saw the same spirit of violence that you saw on October 7th on a much, much, much smaller scale on the streets of Belfast this week. And this has shocked the nation. This also needs to warn the nation. And we'll get the latest from this from Andrew Miller, who covers not just the United States, but the whole English-speaking world as well.
Yeah, this was just a horrifying attack. The whole thing was caught on video, happened Monday night in Belfast, where a Sudanese national, Hadi Aladid, was walking through Belfast, attacked a local resident, a local Irish resident, threw him to the ground, sat on him, straddled him, pulled out a knife, gouged out his left eye, just started hacking at his face, his neck, his back. May have got the right eye as well. I think there was the left eye is definitely gone. The right eye looks like it may have taken some damage, and then started sawing at his neck. The onlookers were screaming that he was trying to cut his head off, and that definitely looks like what was happening. Because fortunately for the victim, there were three men nearby who rushed the immigrant. One of them with a hurling stick that was just able to keep beating the immigrant over the head until the police were able to come and arrest him. The victim, Stephen Ogilvie, he's currently in the hospital. Like I said, his left eye is gone. We'll see if the right eye is saved. But it does look like he will live through it. But he'll definitely carry the wounds for the rest of his life. The murderer, he yelled an Islamic phrase. And you kind of have to do some digging to find this because the media did not cover it well. I swear by Allah, or whatever the Arabic word for I swear by Allah is. So there's definitely an Islamist element to this attack. He's in jail now, and is speaking through an Arabic interpreter, because apparently he speaks neither English nor Gaelic. Looking into his background, he's from Khartoum, Sudan. He came into the European Union some undisclosed number of years ago. Lived in Paris for a while before he moved to Dublin and then to Belfast. Claimed asylum in Belfast, and the British Home Office said he could stay there till 2028. So a few more years. So there's rioting in Belfast now. You can see, a lot of cars on fire where people are extremely angry. Because this isn't an isolated incident. This is something that's been a rising problem in Britain, particular Islamic terror attacks like this due to their asylum policies. Looking at British crime statistics is always a little frustrating to me because I feel like they're not always as transparent as the U.S. government is on some of these. They don't do a nationality breakdown by knife crime. The official statistics is the United Kingdom definitely has a knife crime problem, about 50,000 knife attacks a year. The statistic they like to throw out there is about 12% of the knife attacks are done by immigrants, and about 12% of the British population is also immigrants. So immigrants are no more likely than anyone else to attack you with a knife. That's a little deceptive in the way it's phrasing, though, is that I don't think anyone's claiming that the act of immigration causes you to be a knife murderer. It's a particular subset of Islamic immigrants. And so if you break it down, there's actually five ethnicities, including Sudan, Iran, Afghanistan, Somalia, and another one. Five specific Muslim-majority ethnicities that only compromise 0.6% of Britain's population. that are probably responsible for about 6% of the knife crime. That statistic's not official. It's my estimation, but I'm in the ballpark. I think anyone who's kind of been watching the news closely realizes that, like, if you see a story like this, it's usually a Sudanese, an Afghan, a Somali, or a particular subset of immigrants that have come to Britain, claimed asylum, are importing jihadi techniques. The mainstream media, BBC, and other news outlets has attacked anyone who points out these facts as a racist. So there's a huge portion of there's like local people who don't really know what to do about this. And this is the driving factor behind the riots. And obviously, it's never justified to burn up someone else's car because a Muslim immigrant killed somebody. It doesn't even make sense that it's like you're not burning the Muslim's car. the riot is another problem British society is dealing with, but the anger amongst the people is manifesting at a very real problem. And a problem that I think will probably have some political implications. I was looking at this yesterday, and the largest political party in Northern Ireland, Sinn Féin, if I'm pronouncing that right, it's a Marxist party that's main... Sinn Féin. It's a Marxist party that mainly wants Northern Ireland to secede from the United Kingdom and join the rest of Ireland in a socialist republic. They've been guilty of terrorist attacks.
A Catholic socialist republic. They're also a very Catholic.
Well, that's interesting too, because they've been guilty of terrorist attacks of their own in the past, yet they're condemning the riots and saying that, like, Ireland needs immigrants, not racist. So I guess the joke I've heard is that their new policy is Britain out, everyone else in. So it's they're fine with Afghans and Somalis and Sudanese and Iranians coming to Ireland. They just don't want the other Celtic nation across the sea from them that's like almost identical to anyone in the outside world. But even that, I feel like their popularity is taking a hit. They were up at 37% just 4 years ago, and they're down to about 20%, largely because of a backlash against their immigration policy. I don't know how big this trend will get, but even watching the riots this week, I mean, you're seeing, like, with the placards, like, Catholics and Protestants protesting side by side, where they're at least some of them, they're almost willing to put aside their Catholic nationalist versus Ulster loyalist feud temporarily in order to stop Sudani jihadists from beheading people on their streets.
Yeah, it's kind of impressive to have that... that rivalry put aside, but both sides are really struggling and suffering from immigration. I see it when I go to Ireland. Like the island that I was in Ireland a couple of months ago, and yeah, it was very, very different from visiting Ireland 10 years ago. Like the migrant presence is very clear, very obvious. I mean, you see it in the aftermath of the 2008 financial crisis. Like Irish property was dirt cheap. And it was kind of too cheap. It was a bit of an economic catastrophe that prices had tanked so much, and you had entire housing estates that couldn't sell. And now people in Ireland really struggle to get a home because of how much migrants have come in. It's gotten to the point like hotel accommodation is really expensive in Ireland because part of the reason hotels are filled with migrants. It's something that is having a really big impact there, just like it is in Britain, just like it is in so many other places around the world. I mean, what's behind it? Like, this doesn't make sense. Why are so many countries deliberately bringing in migrants that are bringing in social problems, that are bringing in violence in many cases? What's behind the agenda?
I think in many cases that, like I said, the Marxist angle is key to this. It is an orchestrated attack on Western culture and Western heritage. And that you definitely see that in America and some of the more logically minded commentators, even if they are liberal, point this out. I think Bill Maher, he's a comedian and commentator who's mentioned several times that he tells his liberal friends, you can't be pro-Islamist and pro-feminist at the same time. You have to pick a side, because like Islam is innately anti-feminist. This doesn't even make sense. But you do see people like Zoran Mandani, who's a Muslim socialist, where you're actually seeing like Marxist and feminist and transgenders and socialist and ideologies that are not compatible working together against a common enemy, which is your like Anglo-Saxon Christian culture. And I feel like you must have the same thing in Britain, because I'm seeing commentators this week talking about like the Sinn Féin political party. You're like, well, for the last 100 years, your main talking point has been like Irish nationalism, Irish exceptionalism. Ireland should not be part of the United Kingdom. We have our own history. We need to be independent. We need a united Ireland. And now you're talking about like, oh, well, we need more Somali immigrants and we need more Afghan immigrants. And so he's like, so you're obviously not at heart an Irish nationalist party. You're an anti-British party or anti-UK. But you're fine with bringing in immigrants from all over the rest of the world to like undermine Irish identity. And the only logical explanation of it is it is an attack on the island's heritage. Mr. Gerald Froy brings that up powerfully in his book, America Under Attack, where he's talking specifically about God raising up Donald Trump to save America temporarily from a movement that wanted to blot out the name of Israel from under heaven. That's quoting 2 Kings 14, verses 26 through 28, in the context of Britain and America being end-time Israel. So there's this movement to just like blot out end-time Israel, destroy its culture, destroy its traditions, destroy its history. That they needed to be saved from. And so we're definitely seeing, I feel like, this in with immigration, whether it's illegal immigration here in the United States or Muslim immigration in Britain, like this attempt to blot out these countries' culture and history in a way that, like, yeah, the Home Office, they bring some guy who doesn't even speak the local language from Khartoum, one of like the big terrorist hotbeds of the world, completely unvetted. And then if he causes any crimes, they use that as a pretext to like crack down on the people who are upset with that instead of actually dealing with the actual problem. I think when Mr. Stephen Fleury wrote his trumpet brief on this week, he really focused in on like the BBC headline when this happened was like local man goes to hospital after knife attack. So a headline that like if you read it and didn't actually read the article or do your own research on the article, it just sounds like a guy got in a pub brawl after he lost a game of cards and got stabbed, where it's not just knife crime, it's a jihadi beheading attempt that even the media is trying to downplay in its attempt to just bring in all this immigration. And he even likened it to something we were talking about earlier in the program, this verse in Hosea that talks about when Ephraim saw his sickness and Judah saw his wound, he went to the Assyrian, but they could not heal them. And Mr. John Flory has taught for years that that verse about Judah's wound is the peace process. Like, they're viewing in the nation of Judah and Israel, they're viewing Islamic nations and Palestinian nations that want to destroy them as like a negotiating partner. And this peace process with your enemies is their wound. He hasn't been as dogmatic about Ephraim's wound as he has been about Judah's wound. But we definitely see that same mindset in this case, where same as like Judah goes and tries to do a peace process with the Palestinians that's destroying it, or Donald Trump tries to make a nuclear deal with Iran that's going to enable them to get a nuclear weapon. Like I said, the British government and the British media, they're trying to like make these asylum deals to bring in people from some of the worst terrorist hotbeds in the world into like rural communities in Ireland and Britain. And they're causing enormous social problems, but they their desire to just keep negotiating with their enemies is so strong that they let these problems continue. And it is like a mental sickness that's undermining these nations. It's undermining Israel in the Middle East. It's undermining the United Kingdom. And even with this Trump nuclear deal, you could see he does a better job at pointing out some of these sickness, some of the leaders in the other Israelite nations, but it's even affected his thinking to some certain extent.
Yeah, some good points. And you can't really, like, you can't really make sense of this without that spiritual dimension of why are these countries just hurting themselves. What else do you have for us from the English-speaking world? I'm sure you've got some stories from the United States as well.
Yeah, well, I guess just on the topic of like crime, we also had a pretty important story from Mexico that didn't get much coverage. Is the president of Mexico said she would not extradite the governor of Sinaloa to the United States after the U.S. Justice Department indicted him for helping the Sinaloa cartel traffic drugs. Actually, the U.S. has indicted 10 Mexican government officials of helping cartels traffic drugs, and the Mexican government's not going to extradite any of them. So now, the former president of Mexico, Andre Manuel Lopez Obrador, who is actually still kind of the kingpin of Mexico's governing party, his protege is now president, and he's retired, but he's still like the elder statesman of the Morena movement, has come out and basically accused President Trump of election interference, trying to indict politicians from his party so that the conservative party in Mexico will gain power, which he kind of unwittingly is exposing himself in that. The main reason President Trump's indicting politicians from his party is his party, the Morena movement, has basically formed like a state cartel alliance where they're not just turning a blind eye to cartel activity, but they're actually actively facilitating it. And so this is a huge national security threat for the United States, to where I feel like from the time Nixon declared his war on drugs in 1971 to probably about 2012, it was very much the U.S. government and the Mexican government against the cartels. We're now, under Morena, we're kind of moving into a new age where it's the Mexican government and the cartels against the United States. And so this is just really upping the ante on the drug violence the U.S. is going to be dealing with on its southern border. Another story that ties into just kind of like this orchestrated attack on like Western values is, for years, a think tank here in the United States you may have heard of, the Southern Poverty Law Center, has positioned itself as kind of like the national expert on like far-right extremism, white nationalism, neo-fascism, and has really been trying to slander Donald Trump and the Republicans of working with fascists to destroy the country. Now they've actually been indicted for giving something to the tune of like $4 million to the very neo-fascist groups they claim to be protecting the nation from. Now, their excuse for that is they're like, oh, well, we're using that money to pay informants within the movement. But it's definitely, when you're digging into the extent of it, it's more than paying informants.
This is a story I just don't see. And I just wonder, am I missing something? Because a lot of people talk about this, because it's 4 million across, I think, about 10 years and around a dozen organizations. So that's, what, 400,000 per year, then about 10 organizations. We're looking at 30, 40 grand per organization per year. I mean, maybe support for these organizations is so tiny that that's actually a lot of money. Do you know, like, what percentage of the funding of these organizations came from the SPLA, the Southern Poverty Law Center?
I can find that out. You're right. They're tiny organizations, so it doesn't take a ton of money. And some of the evidence, I guess, could be more anecdotal and like not in the scale of the funding, but particularly like who was funding. Because I'll give two examples that Congress is investigating this week. One of them, it was the leader of Aryan Nations, which is not a huge group. But he basically had decided that he was fed up with white supremacy and wanted out of the movement. And instead of helping him getting out of the movement, they offered to pay him maybe $1,200 a month, so not a ton of money, but to basically stay in the organization and then report to them. Given the fact that he was the leader, though, you could get a pretty good case that, like, if he would have gotten out of it, like, the movement may have just, that particular group, Aryan Nations, may have just fallen apart. I guess maybe that's a little speculative, but like that may have just fallen apart if it wasn't for the fact that the guy who was trying to just get out of it was, like, paid to keep it together. Like, we need to, like, let's keep this group here. There's another one this week where they actually, it wasn't Aryan Nations, but the SPLC liaison with the group was not only paying this informant a salary, they were sleeping with them as well. So it's, I think the headline was something that, like, SPLC in bed with this white supremacist group that was, like, actual literally. So it's like they're, and similar to where it's, I mean, their argument is like, okay, well, they're in here and they're informing, but there's clearly a strong personal relationship with the SPLC in a group so tiny that, like I said, without some of these key figures, they may just have fallen apart. When I read it, it reminded me, I grew up in Michigan, of the Wolverine Watchmen scandal from like 2 or 3 years back, where there was a militia group in Michigan that had made a plot to kidnap the governor of Michigan, Gretchen Whitmer, during the COVID lockdowns. And then and I feel like a lot of the people they arrested for that eventually got let off due to entrapment. Is they actually found out that within the Wolverine Watchmen, this isn't even an exaggeration, there were more FBI informants than there were actual, like, legitimate militia members. And the FBI informants were not just informing, but they were actually involved in planning. So they basically, the FBI basically orchestrated a plot to kidnap Gretchen Whitmer and then arrested everyone who went along with it. And so you can argue, like, okay, yeah, like, the people who went along with it, they committed some crimes and they did some bad things, but just under, like, U.S. law, like I said, you can't actually arrest someone from a crime that the government orchestrated for them to do. And so this SPLC, I mean, they're in congressional hearings this week. So, I mean, maybe we will find more, and maybe it will be ruled that it was just all observe and report. But I think given, like you said, with this one lady who was sleeping with the informant or this other guy where they're actually paying like the head of it, it gets to the point where like when the head of Aryan Nations actually works for an anti-white supremacist group, it's like okay, yeah, he could give you some valuable information on the group. However, the group might not survive long without him either. So like the easier way you can get that. And so you can definitely with like a follow the money trail. I mean, the theory is that like if Aryan Nations falls apart and a couple other groups like that falls apart, we don't even need an SPLC anymore. Like they don't actually have a function in society. So yeah, it's, I guess you do raise some good points with like how much of this is, it's not unheard of for law enforcement to put informants in groups. We do it with drug cartels all the time. But it's I'll be curious to see what new information this congressional investigation turns up. It was like, says, was this like putting a guy with a wire in a drug cartel, or was this actually just keeping a movement alive that probably wouldn't survive without a little help?
Yeah, I do think those examples that you gave make this idea that the SPLC was keeping these groups alive much more credible, that when you're using that money to persuade the head of an organization to stick around rather than quit, that is quite a dramatic investment. Was there anything else you wanted to do?
The other story I brought, I think I touched on this already, was just the inflation example. We talked about this a little bit back during talk about Iran deal, is that the inflation rate of the U.S., we got some bad news this week. It's up to like 4.3%. Still not as bad as the 9.1% it hit under Biden. But worse than it's been in 3 years. And like I said, they said the reason for it is this is a little different than Bidenflation, where Bidenflation was mostly caused by the fact that the Federal Reserve pumped massive amounts of money into the economy to help stimulate it after the COVID lockdowns. So like $1 in $5 in circulation today has been created since the COVID pandemic. And so obviously all that money just diluted the money supply and made the dollar worth a lot less. This inflation we're seeing right now, core inflation, which excludes food and gas prices, which are kind of volatile, is only up slightly to 2.9%. So the core inflation's still relatively low. The reason the overall inflation's up to 4.3% is not monetary devaluation so much as it is that the Iran war has driven fuel prices up. The average price for a gallon of gasoline in the United States this week is about $4.25, a little cheaper than that in Oklahoma. So that obviously gasoline's a big part of your budget to fill up your car. But more than that, everything you buy in a grocery store got there on a semi-truck that also had to fill up the truck. So the price of both food and gasoline is way up, even though the price of most other things is roughly the same.
Well, thank you for that, Andrew. I'll just bring another UK story quickly, seeing as we were talking about Northern Ireland. Britain's Defence Minister John Healey quit yesterday. Then I think the Armed Forces Minister, kind of like his deputy, he also quit the same day. And the reason is about a long-awaited publication of spending plans for the US military. the Defense Minister John Healey, he, in his resignation letter, he told the Prime Minister Keir Starmer, "You have been unable and the Treasury has been unwilling to commit the resources that the nation needs to defend the country at this time of rising threats." And he's very unhappy about the amount of money being spent on the military. The Prime Minister has had a lot of speeches where he's talked about the need to invest in Britain's military, and he's not following through on that. And the reason is, Britain's socialist government is about, we've run out of other people's money. It's very hard for the government to borrow at a rate beyond what it is borrowing right now. It's still borrowing, but borrow at a faster rate each year, and markets are going to stop lending. About a quarter of total government spending goes to pensions and benefits, and the government has demonstrated they will not change those one iota. In fact, there was a leaked text from the disgraced Labour grandee, Lord Peter Mandelson, where he said, "Every meeting I have is, who can we tax in order to pay benefits to others?" About 10% of the budget goes already on interest to national debt, so that's absorbing an increasing amount of government money. So if they're... And then I think if you look at tax revenue, I think the government is close to the maximum money that it can raise from taxes. It can, of course, raise taxes further, but you then risk harming the economy, and then you bring in more tax, you bring in fewer taxes overall, despite the higher rate. And I think we've probably crossed that point already in Britain's economy, where you can't really get much more by raising taxes further. So where can they get more money for defense from? They'd have to cut other parts of the budget, but they won't do that. And this is what led then to the defense minister quitting. It also piles pressure now on Keir Starmer. He's already, basically, his leadership challenge is on pause. He is pretty much out of office. He's a zombie prime minister. But the leadership challenge has been paused while Manchester Mayor Andy Burnham, who's his main rival, gets a seat in Parliament from which he can challenge him. That by-election will be held on June 18th. And then after that, the fight for leadership will be on. And this is yet another wound for Starmer, making it much less likely he will be able to stay on. So, I mean, economic curses for Britain, but also just Britain having caused its own economic problems with insane decisions that are then hurting the military. The nation cannot keep itself safe because of that. Well, some other just important stories from Europe this week. Pope Leo was visiting Spain over the weekend. He got a very warm welcome. On Sunday, he was greeted by 1.2 million people. Real Madrid, when they won the Champions League in 2024, they only drew half the number. So it's pretty impressive to be more popular in Madrid than Real Madrid. And he got a lot there. He addressed Spain's Parliament, the Congress of Deputies, on Monday, and he's continued his pacifist message. "Every war ultimately constitutes a painful defeat for the capacity to negotiate," he said. "True security, however, stems from justice, patient dialogue, respect for international law, and a policy of placing the lives of people above the interests that profit from war." You know, he doesn't see the evil that needs to be defeated by war. I mean, you have what's going on in Iran. I mean, ultimately, World War II was not won by negotiation. And I think most right-thinking people, you can apparently see things more clearly than Pope Leo, would know that standing up and fighting evil, fighting the Nazis in World War II was the right thing to do, not trying to solve World War II via dialogue. You know, of course, in a perfect world, you rely on God to fight your battles for you. But even that is not, that's very different from relying on dialogue and compromise to make peace. And it, of course, also completely overlooks a lot of Catholic history of violence. That's something Josué Michels talks about in an article we have on our website. "Pope glorifies Spain's history, attacks US and Israel," that writes up that visit. You can get that at our website, thetrumpet.com. Some other important bits of news this week. Lithuania placed a $1.2 billion order for military vehicles from Mercedes-Benz. They called it one of their largest investments in their logistic capabilities. So they are quite quickly rearming. I thought this was an interesting one. Just 11% of Europeans view the United States as an ally, according to a new European Council on Foreign Relations survey that was published this week. That's a 50% decline since November 2024 and an all-time low. A majority of about 20,000 people surveyed across 15 European nations found that a majority did not believe America would defend them in time of an attack. So Europe is turning against the United States, and the United States and Donald Trump is helping that happen in many ways. And you're seeing Europe building up its own ability to defend itself. Now, it's also having some roadblocks in its own ability to defend itself. This week, the Future Air Combat System, this joint project between France, Germany, and Spain, was officially shelved. This was meant to be a pretty massive next-generation fighter jet, but France essentially torpedoed the whole project by getting greedy. Last year, they said they wanted 80% of the project. So that means, in essence, 80% of the planes being built in France, 80% of this money from three countries being spent on aircraft, being spent in France. Of course, the rest of the country said no. They've spent a year trying to talk France around. They failed. The whole thing has fallen apart. So this is why Europe needs a strong leader. And you're not going to see Europe reach that full military potential that the Bible talks about until it has that strong leader in place. But a lot of this appetite for a strong leader, a lot of this appetite for military rearmament, a huge amount of that is being driven by Russia, and it's being driven by what is going on in Ukraine. And Ukraine passed an important milestone this week. The conflict has been going on now for longer than World War One. I can't believe that it has really been that long, but we'll get the latest on that conflict, on that milestone, and what that means from our Asia correspondent, Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, that's right. As of Wednesday, this full-scale war has run 1,568 days. And that means it's now, as you said, run longer than World War I. World War I, back in the 1910s, was 1,567 days long. So it's official. Russia's war is now longer. And we know that Russian President Vladimir Putin and his officials thought that they could quickly neutralize Ukraine, much in the way that it had gone with Ukraine's Crimean Peninsula about 9 years earlier. Putin believed that it would be little more than a weekend excursion to seize Kyiv, topple Ukraine's leadership, collapse its command structure, and force some sort of a political settlement before any of the nations of the world really had time to react. He thought that it could all be done in a few days, or maybe weeks if there were hiccups. And actually, the Russians were not alone in that miscalculation. Since Russia is branded as having the world's second most powerful military, most of us thought that they would quickly prevail. But the difference between the time in 2014 with the Crimean Peninsula and the invasion beginning in 2022 was that the Ukrainians were much better prepared and much better trained this time around, and far more resolved as well. So here we are just about 4.5 years later, and Ukraine's president is still in Kyiv. Ukrainian forces are still furiously contesting every mile of battlefield. They've actually been pushing back especially hard in the last month or so. And on most days, Russia's gains are either negligible or non-existent. Russia's economy is also under serious strain, especially since Ukrainians have been targeting more and more of their energy infrastructure, and the resolve of the Ukrainians seems to just keep on hardening. So that's where we are now that this war has run longer than World War I, and a fair number of analysts are saying that the pressure on Russia is unsustainable, and that sooner or later the nation's system will crack and that Putin himself will be pushed out of power. But Putin has proven himself remarkably crafty throughout this war. He has persuaded many Russians that this is an existential struggle for their nation's survival, that if they lose the war, then Russia itself could collapse. And at the same time, Putin has reshaped his nation's economy around the war. And he has strengthened Russia's ties with China and North Korea and even India and Iran. So Putin has friends to keep on buying Russian energy. And some of these partners have also supplied significant quantities of military equipment. In the case of North Korea, they've even supplied troops to fight alongside the Russians. So Putin is a survivor. He's shrewd and he's resourceful. And through these measures, he has defied all the predictions of Russia's collapse and of his own ouster. And he's kept this conflict grinding on for now longer than the length of World War I. And biblical prophecy shows that Putin's ambitions extend far beyond this current war. In early 2022, shortly after Russia expanded its conflict into this full-scale invasion, Trump editor-in-chief Gerald Flurry published an article called Bible Prophecy Comes Alive in Ukraine. One passage of this article says, "I've been warning for years that Vladimir Putin would be responsible for violent conquests and would set in motion some astonishing and historic events." End quote. And then from there, Mr. Flurry explains that the reason why he's been warning about Putin for so long is biblical prophecy. He spends quite a bit of time examining a prophecy in Ezekiel 38. That's a chapter that focuses largely on an individual called the Prince of Rosh, or the Prince of Russia. And Mr. Flurry identifies this figure as Vladimir Putin. And he says that these prophecies show that this so-called prince will soon be waging wars far greater and more catastrophic than the current one that he's waging in Ukraine. And even though that article was published in 2022, it remains highly relevant today, so I would recommend it to any listener who wants to understand Russia's aggression within that framework. Once again, that article is called Bible Prophecy Comes Alive in Ukraine.
Thank you very much for that, Jeremiah. And I think we do see the results of the impact of that war on Europe every single week, and probably even every single day. We have a news article of Europe changing in response to what is happening there. What else do you have for us from the Asia region?
First up, a major earthquake struck off the coast of the Philippines early on Monday. This was a 7.8 magnitude earthquake hitting off the coast of Mindanao Island. The shock destroyed thousands of homes and other buildings, and it triggered several landslides. So far, the death count is up to 53 from this disaster, and more than 400 people were injured. And then there were also more than 10,000 people who have been displaced. So a very serious earthquake there that caused a great deal of destruction and suffering. And we have a booklet called Why Natural Disasters that explains from a theological standpoint, why these kinds of calamities happen. And then one final story here about Chinese General Secretary Xi Jinping visiting North Korea this week. This actually marks Xi Jinping's first trip to North Korea in 7 years. And the two of them, he and Kim Jong-un, vowed to strengthen strategic ties between their nations and to keep on safeguarding their security and their development interests. They also made some deals to deepen cooperation in agriculture and healthcare, science, technology, and trade. So the China-North Korea partnership keeps on growing stronger. And this partnership is an important part of a pan-Asian alliance that was foretold in biblical prophecy and that is now taking shape.
Well, thank you for that, Jeremiah. I just wanted to bring one final, I don't know, a little bit fun story, I guess, right at the end, something that caught my eye this week, and that is that Elon Musk is the world's first trillionaire. That is pretty mind-blowing. Like, a billionaire is very hard to wrap your mind around, $1,000 million, but a trillionaire. Jeff Bezos, Bill Gates, these are all paupers compared to Elon Musk. They are left in the dust. I think it's Larry Page, the former Google owner, that is the second richest man, valued at about 300 billion. You're around a third now of what Elon Musk is worth. And that is because SpaceX's IPO, or initial public offering, yesterday that made shares available to the general public. They snapped them up. It raised $75 billion for the company, but the value that these shares were sold at values the whole of SpaceX at $1.8 trillion. So if SpaceX is really worth $1.8 trillion, then Musk's share of SpaceX is worth $866 billion. And then you put in his what he owns from Tesla and other assets, and you get his total net worth of 1.1 trillion. And hopefully I keep my billions and millions and trillions straight. They sound so similar, but mean very different things. Now, is SpaceX really worth that much? Like, okay, we've had this IPO, but there's a lot of companies have had IPOs that are way overvalued and they've crashed back down. Could this happen to SpaceX? Well, SpaceX is losing a lot of money. They lost $5 billion in 2025. They made $4.3 billion in losses in just the first quarter of 2026. Most of those losses come from XAI, the artificial intelligence kind of business. I think Grok is associated with that. And that was wrapped into SpaceX last year. Starlink is profitable. Starlink generated $4.4 billion in profit in 2025. Not enough to make up for the massive spending in AI data centers and all of that. But even then, you know, a company making $4.4 billion in profit a year, that's still a pretty, that's not much to be valued $1.8 trillion for. Investors, they'll often look at price to earnings ratio. SpaceX, they're making losses. They don't have an earnings. So then they'll also look at price to sales ratio. So Amazon's current valuation is about 3.5 times their annual sales. Microsoft is about 9.3 times their annual sales. Going by this value for SpaceX, it's 100 times its annual sales. So yeah, they may well be very overvalued. But then how do you put a price on space? You look at the potential and where SpaceX could go. And SpaceX conducted 165 Falcon 9 rocket launches last year, about half of all U.S. national security launches. No other private company is better positioned to kind of come in there and dominate space. Their gigantic Starship model is coming along faster and faster, the largest, most powerful rocket ever made. And you look at the potential riches in space. Last year, scientists estimated there are about $1 trillion in precious metals on the moon. NASA estimated that one asteroid, 16 Psyche, I'm not sure which. But anyway, they estimated that it contains $10 quintrillion of metals at current market values. $10 million trillion. That's the equivalent roughly of the annual economic output of the entire planet for 100,000 years. One asteroid. A lot of potential wealth. You go further afield, you get even more ridiculous numbers. The planet 55 Canceri E is believed to be about one-third diamond. If you price that at the value of rough diamonds on Earth today, it's about $27 nonillion in wealth, which you could look it up. It's 27 with 30 zeros after it, as long as I counted that correctly. Insane, insane figures. And this is clearly silly. You know, SpaceX is not going to be mining diamonds from 55 Canceri E. You're even a trillion in precious metals on the moon, you'd probably spend more than $1 trillion to try and get them out and over to the Earth where they're useful. But it does put the focus on the amount of wealth that is out there. I think the giant IPO reflects public excitement about science and technology and about space. And then also some more serious kind of sober considerations about, well, could mankind potentially tap just a fraction of some of this wealth and raw materials that is out there? And part of the reason this caught my eye is our recent May-June Trumpet print magazine, God's Space Program. Or Lift Up Your Eyes is on the cover, and then God's Space Program is Mr. Gerald Flurry's cover article. He wrote there, what NASA and other space projects are doing is exciting. They lift our eyes upwards and stir our hearts. I mean, the fact that investors put up $75 billion, and the IPO, I think, was twice oversubscribed. So people were willing to put up $150 billion to invest in space. They're excited and stirred about space. But there's a better investment. Mr. Flurry goes on to say, but God wants us to have an even more inspiring vision, his space program. And that is a much more inspiring vision of using the resources of space, but not just to make money with a private company. In Isaiah 45, verse 18, God says he created earth and the heavens, and puts it the other way around there, the way we're more used to hearing, heavens and the earth. But it says, for both of these, he created them to be inhabited. And it goes on to say, well, he doesn't make anything in vain. So the diamonds that are out there on that planet, that's not in vain. The wealth of 16 psyche, that is not in vain. He's preparing man to work with the wealth and the resources while on Earth first, and then go out into the universe. And so I think if you think about it in those terms, Elon Musk becoming the world's first trillionaire is kind of an exciting and inspiring topic to end on. And again, I'll point you to our Trumpet Print magazine with Lift Up Your Eyes on the cover for more on that incredible, inspiring vision. Well, thank you so much for joining us today. That is all we have time for on the show. Thank you to Matthew Friesen for engineering and production, as well as to all of our panelists for their efforts. If you have any questions, any comments, you can get in touch with us at trumpetworld@thetrumpet.com. We'd be very happy to hear from you. We'll be back with our regular show on Wednesday next week. Until then, keep watching your world.